The problem is you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name's Nish Nikolic, and my guest today is Dr. Christoph Klib. He is a postdoctoral research fellow at the School of Psychology at University of Queensland. His research is at the intersection of social, environmental, and moral psychology. He studies factors influencing people's support for systemic climate change policies, public attitudes towards biodiversity, as well as the function of aesthetic judgments and their role in morality. It was a great pleasure to speak with Dr. Klib about his views on the morality of climate change, being a very balanced view that he took, which was quite refreshing, as sometimes these spaces can be quite polarizing, and it's just wonderful to hear his different points of view while still being able to hold a strong position that is still in line with research and one's values. Hope you enjoy this episode. Christoph, a big thank you for coming onto the program today. Really looking forward to having a conversation together and exploring this space, this intersection, I suppose, between, you know, the social world, the environmental world, and moral psychology. You know, the big conversation these days is very much around climate change and how we feel about it. I know that even in our therapy, I hear about it a lot. There's a conversation going on all the time. So I'm really eager to have a conversation with you today to find out more, your learnings and research and the like in this general space.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. Thank you.
Let me ask you, how did you get into this space? I'm always fascinated we find ourselves in these areas. Is it a deliberate thing? Is it you kind of fall into it? You already had a nature that was leading in that direction. What happened?
So, I mean, I guess I have a more maybe theoretical part of my research, which is more the research on morality, and then the more applied one, which is climate change. And actually the morality one goes far back, but so back in high school, I was actually very into philosophy, and I was even planning to study maybe philosophy and even do it academically. So I was always in between, back then, between psychology and philosophy. So I was reading a lot of kind of moral philosophy, Peter Singer and others. So I always had kind of this interest, and then I kind of did psychology. I would say my undergrad did a bit different stuff. I studied like empathy, autism a bit. But then at some point I kind of realized there's like this field of moral psychology where I can actually study morality and find out about it in a psychological way. So I was reading about it, I got into it, and then I applied for a PhD about that. And so the stuff more on climate change, I guess it's more applied in some way. Well, this just goes back to that I just do care about climate change, that it's a big issue. And it's something that's kind of painful to see that climate change is happening. And also more recently, so I'm doing some stuff on biodiversity. And that's also feels quite personal, that it feels just painful for myself to see that species get extinct. And I just feel like the need, I want to maybe help in some way, or at least trying to be able to explain why people care or not care about biodiversity and climate change.
It's interesting whenever I talk with someone or think about this space around climate change, it feels like the word climate change is this overarching space that doesn't say much, other than I think confuses people, and it kind of like becomes this backdrop of a topic versus when someone goes out and raises topics or items like species becoming extinct on the planet, we all understand what that is. And there's a real easy way to connect with that and understand, like, this is not something that we are for, you know, to think about how our oceans, for example, have been fished, or probably fished is the wrong word, that, you know, we've put this huge emphasis on catching fish with ginormous nets. You know, no one's fishing. We're just netting out. I think I don't know this world well enough, but when you do this in an unsustainable way year after year, and you're trying to feed, you know, 8 billion people or thereabouts, there's going to be some devastating effects.
This is actually a pretty good point, because, like, climate change, for one, it's quite an abstract term, and, like, we don't really know what does it exactly mean, because it kind of involves just a lot of elements, sea level rise, floods, and there's a lot of uncertainty in there. So that makes it very hard to connect to it. And actually, your point on, like, animal becoming extinct, be more concrete, is a very good one, also because we kind of talk a lot about biodiversity now in terms of climate change. So climate change kind of reducing biodiversity. But the reality is that it is an overlapping issue, but it's still actually quite different. And if you look at what predicts or the causes for biodiversity loss, it has a lot to do with kind of extraction of, like mining, like land use, which are also related to climate change, but it's still a bit separate one. Like, pollution is another one. It's more related to biodiversity loss than climate change. So there's, like, kind of different issues there, all kind of discussed within climate change. And this makes it a bit harder to connect to. And what we also feel is that, like, or see if people, if you ask them, do you care about biodiversity? Do you care about animals getting extinct? Most people do care. But if we talk about climate change, it's now very polarized, very, very politicized. So not as many people say they do care about climate change. So if you bring it back to this kind of where people can connect to, which is animals getting extinct, it's a much higher concern, because nobody, or, like, not many people actually are okay with our species getting extinct.
There's also, I think, a bit of a problem with how some media has gone out and reported on climate change, when we're so alarmist with making statements that just simply don't come true. I think, invalidates a point. And unfortunately, the point, I feel, is more about, if we can just talk about factual things rather than making ridiculous predictions that, you know, I mean, scientists don't make these types of predictions. We tend to be, you know, either caveat around these predictions, or we give them a much more reasonable response. But it's so much easier to go out and say, you know, it's going to be devastating to the world if we lose these species, because these species are related with these, you know, environmental factors, and then that has a cascading effect. And we don't exactly know what's going to occur, but just generally kind of makes sense that it's not good to wipe out species that have been on this earth for a, you know, extended period of time, versus an alarmist response saying, you know, if this, you know, if climate goes up by X, you know, or, you know, if we get this many, I don't know, items per unit in the sea, or in the, then it's going to have those catastrophic effects. And fortunately, it's very hard to point to those, or, and I don't think the scientists are necessarily saying that, but I think the media has a lot to answer for, because it's not helpful to make such ridiculous claims and without, I think, a more nuanced conversation. Because if we boil it down to loss of species of animals, I mean, who doesn't go out and say, why would we do this? That's kind of like, it's almost like using the word, you know, well, extinction is the best word, because I don't think it's loaded. It's just factual.
Yeah. And there it kind of ties back to morality. I mean, climate change is a very moralized issue. And if people see an issue as kind of moralized or moral issue, they go more to extremes. And they're also not as much maybe interested in actual factual information. And it's actually very sad that an issue like climate change became so politicized and moralized, because it should be something that we all care about. We care about our environment, we care about species. And by becoming politicized, people see it as part of their identity. They're more likely to have like a us versus them dynamic, look down on people that think differently than them. And they're also more likely to maybe consume media that's very one-sided. So that's kind of part of the problem. If whenever an issue becomes very moralized, then it kind of drives people apart. And it's much harder to actually find a common ground. And it's particularly quite strong in Australia. So if you look at across the world where climate change is the most politicized, we find it's the USA and Australia, where it's like very much where you politically stand, that's also your view on climate change, whether you're left, you're right. We find this also to a bit lesser degree in Europe, but we don't find this at all in many countries in the world. So most countries, actually, climate change is not politicized. Whether you care or not has nothing to do with whether you stand on the left or right. It's just a bit of a separate issue. But in countries, especially USA and Australia, it's very much tied to your political identity. And that makes people be more angry about it, more like seeing the others as kind of the enemy or the other group. Whether you're a greenie or you're a coal miner, you're kind of this complete separate type of people, and you don't even want to have anything to do with each other.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm going to ask you a question as to how you think those countries do that, but I can see the moment you politicize it, we lose the point. I think most of us are united about these topics. It's so simple. We have this very easy, I think, in Australia, idea about don't throw rubbish on the ground. Like we've got Clean Up Australia Day that we've you did for many years, and there was huge campaigns about it. A recent one was don't be a tosser, meaning don't toss something out of the window when you're driving. We look down on it. I'm a camping enthusiast, and there's often a conversation about clean up after yourself. Don't leave rubbish where you're camping. Look after the environment. We do that at the beach as well. So it's looked down upon. So we all kind of get it, but it is funny that the moment it's politicized, it's kind of like a for and against that we somehow are holding different positions. When I think if we're more factual, we tend to lean all in the same direction. How we execute change can be debated, and I think that should be vigorous and considered. It's good to know that other countries are not doing it in that way. Any thoughts about or any examples, exemplars of countries that do it well, and how they've done it, and why it's different in like the US, why it's showing up a bit differently in Australia too?
I'm not fully sure, but like some countries that are not as politicized are, I mean, there are a lot of African countries, but also South American. Why that exactly is the case, this can only be, I mean, speculated. I mean, it has been speculated that it has a lot to do with also like in Australia, there's strong mining companies that, of course, they're like the division already emerged from this more that you have big corporations that actually also trying like to steer up maybe some division. So you find this more strongly in countries that are highly reliant on fossil fuels, because there is much more of an economic interest in there. And I also need to say, so people where it's not political, or like countries where it's not politicized, doesn't necessarily mean that these countries care much more. It just means that it's more like there could be still differences in terms of maybe income, class, race, whatnot. But it's not so much about this kind of politicized left and right issue. So it doesn't mean that in other countries there's not an issue. But having said this, so in a lot of poorer countries, or also countries that are affected by climate change, like Mexico, Colombia, a lot of Latin American countries, concern for climate change is much higher than in countries like in Australia. Much fewer people deny that climate change is happening. And I guess the reason is that people in these countries are also much more affected by climate change. So they see more the consequences. It never became, and then at the same time, their economy is also less reliant on fossil fuels. So you have a situation where these countries are actually quite vulnerable to climate change. They're also less wealthy, so they can less adapt to it. And they're also not as, they don't have the same economic interest in like continuing use of fossil fuels. So you have a kind of situation, there's kind of no incentive to polarize or politicize this issue. While in countries like Australia that are very reliant on fossil fuels, there's much more this kind of incentive where you have different interest groups. And I'm not saying that different interest groups don't have their kind of reasons. Like, of course, if you live in a mining community, it's very understandable you're worried about losing your job because like it's very tied to the economy and to your job that we export coal. But that's kind of how it emerges.
It's interesting in this topic because it often, I think, derails as to what people are talking about, and there tends to be a lack of definitions, or we kind of miss information in the definitions. For example, I don't think that there is an argument to be made that the climate isn't changing. But I think there might be an argument as to what are the causes. And to me, it's kind of odd that we would deny something. I mean, not that I've actually looked at into it, but I just have to believe that the science, you know, that we're just recording it and it's saying, yes, it's going up. Why is that even a concern? Why would we not believe science saying it's going up? I think there is a good debate to go out and say, is it caused by this? Is it caused by that? What's the policies in place? You know, at the same time, this is, that was a point of saying, who in their right mind goes out and says, I think it's useful to burn oil that we pump out of the ground continuously in, you know, probably millions or billions of liters daily ongoing, and think that's a good idea. You know, we wouldn't run that experiment inside a house and think that that was reasonable. We do technological change and the like. That's very simple, at least in my mind. I can definitely see, though, how there could be commercial interests to go out and say, you know, oh, well, no, we're doing now, you know, clean coal or something.
Yeah.
It's like clean coal. That's a nice way of saying coal. You know, I can't say I'm, you know, going to go to the toilet and, you know, excrete clean defecation. It's not, it's got a bacteria in it or whatever it might be. When you're burning something, it burns you know, chemicals into the atmosphere. And I don't need to be a scientist to figure that out. That is just common sense. Is there room for debate as to what is useful? You know, how do we go out and put policy in place, and how will that policy affect countries? I think absolutely, because it's really hard to go out and disconnect, for example, technological change with improvements of lifespan and lifestyle, and to go out and say to poorer countries, you can't go out now and burn coal or have these other technologies freely. Can be devastating for those people, can actually lead to lots of death that could be avoided. And then there's a debate around, you know, the harm on the world and the environment versus harm on people. But I think that's a healthy conversation to have.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
Yeah, I think that there are like two different things in here. So I think where there's no debate, or like at least in a scientific sense, not any debate anymore that climate change is happening. And also we know what causes it, that it's mostly the burning of fossil fuels. So there's not really any debate around that. But of course there is, and there should be debate about what are we going to do? Which policies are we going to implement? And this is also not what it's not just a scientific question. I mean, there are scientific answers. What is the most effective policy? But it's also a social question. So we need to decide as a society what we want. And I think like kind of policies that don't recognize like different views, for example, the views and the fears of people living in coal-relying communities in Queensland, where I also live, is this can be very harmful, not only to the people, but also to society in general. Because we don't want to end up where we have kind of a fraction society, where people are kind of, yeah, like having much more us versus them dynamics. We don't want to go there. So we kind of need to think about a way that includes everyone. And I think that's very important. And the same if you look globally, what you said, yeah, there are some poorer countries, if they just went right away to like net zero, it would actually very much harm them. So we also need to like globally think about how can we actually like have a global society which also cares about people that might get very much disadvantaged, both within the country and also globally. Because otherwise we end up in a society where there's much more divisions. And that's what we see in other countries like the USA. And it's kind of good that Australia is not as fractioned, not as polarized yet. And I think most people believe we don't want to go there. So we also need to find ways not to, go in this direction.
It feels to me that when reasonable people sit down and we push aside media reports, I think we tend to agree more than disagree. When we agree on facts, and look, we can dispute facts as to, how much percent does this contribute to that, and they should be questioned because that's a scientific rigor, and it's interesting and it's stimulating. But there's those moral things that I think most of us can really simply appreciate and try and work with, because when we're making decisions, we're also not only just looking at the facts. There are moral considerations to look at, and there are those scenarios of, the ones, I suppose, psychology 101. There are people in a boat, and who do you have to throw out? Because it's going to sink, and someone's going to go out, and there's a moral, and ethical dilemma about how you approach that. And that's very much life. And when we look at the commonalities, and maybe that's where we should start, is asking, what do we have in common? What do we believe in common? And there's those simple things. We don't believe we should kill more species. That's not helpful.
Yeah, I think if people just sit together and they talk, there's much more agreement than we usually believe. But if we mostly, I mean, social media, of course, is part of the problem, like, but also media. We see other people that don't believe, like, don't view the world or have other political beliefs other than us. It's kind of in a very stereotypical way we look down on them. So if I'm an environmental activist, I live in Melbourne, I'm an environmental activist, I'm kind of very much looking down on these kind of rural communities in Queensland because they don't care about climate change. Why are they not doing anything? And the same way goes the other way around. If I'm like in a rural community in Queensland, I feel like, why are these arrogant people in Melbourne like dictating how I should live? They all actually have only bad intentions about our country. So kind of we have like these very strong beliefs. But I think they wouldn't be as strong if people actually engage with each other and had conversation. But it's very much amplified through media, through social media and other means. And that's kind of, a big issue, I mean, in modern society in a lot of countries where these societies drift apart because, like, the communication is mostly we only see the worst part of the other group and not actually kind of like the common humanity, if I say it like that. Yeah.
And maybe part that that's part of the challenge that we face is there's that natural human heuristic to take shortcuts, that to go out and hold information, to maintain a curious point of view and inquire,
yeah,
is hard. It creates cognitive load and we tend to avoid it. You know, I'm sure if we went up to Queensland and we spoke with farmers as an example, and we tried to understand how they live and what the actual cost is and the forcing functions are around how you go out and do farming, we would actually recognize it's a very complicated and difficult thing to do. It's not a simple endeavor that you just go out and destroy the land. You know, it would be the opposite side. I imagine that it's quite challenging, and there's lots of limitations and constraints, and there's a commercial world that you have to try and abide by, and so on and so forth. And vice versa, if we then went down to Melbourne, you know, or Sydney or Canberra or wherever it might be, and asked, you know, what does a modern life look like, and what are the limitations, and what are our general footprint of, you know, carbon emissions and so on and so forth. It's complicated to live a life, you know, and we are extremely resource hungry. And most of us, you know, although we might hold a moral position, it's hard to live by a moral position, you know, like, and rather than going out and critiquing each other and say, you know, why don't you ride a bike to, you know, work or something, you know, it becomes very non-functional to try and live that sort of lifestyle. And that's, you know, a huge ship to turn around. Society won't be able to achieve that. You know, we need big policy changes and governmental regulation or incentives. You know, I always think about, you know, tell me the incentives and I'll tell you what happens. That's not my message, but I've heard it somewhere and I agree with it. You know, if we look at where the incentives are, that's what people do. If you incentivize solar panels and roofs, people will do it. If you take the incentive away, they won't do it because it's just not commercially viable.
Yeah, and like part of my research focuses on also like how can we, like, what are the factors influencing the people actually support more these kind of broader systemic policies for climate change and other environmental issue, because like all our like individual behavior is important. But I mean, as you see, the issue becomes, if you like, it becomes like a society where we just like criticize each other's behaviors and focus too much, while often the bigger issues are the broader kind of systemic, maybe policies we need. Maybe we need like invest more in kind of solar farms. We need to like do all of these things, which is more like on a kind of country level. But for people not engaging in kind of individual behavior, can, for one, it's only a small part of the problem, but also there can be different reasons. So some people may not have actually the resources or like the money to install their own solar panels at their home. So as you say, this needs to be subsidized. And so we engage then in a conversation where we are very critical or judging each other's behavior instead of like focusing maybe more on like the bigger issues at hand.
Mm. So easy to point, right? And critique versus try and inquire and be curious, you know, asking questions. Why would someone throw rubbish on the ground? You know, and I think the answers tend to talk to other systemic issues more so than you just need to put a bin up. You know, the solution is not put bins everywhere. Nor do we want to live in an environment where we require bins to be in every location, because that's not how we want the aesthetics of the world to look, nor will it fix it either, because there's going to be a population that too much has gone on in their life. They don't have that cognitive resource at the time. Or there's probably other implications that are unknown, right? Like anytime you try something, you don't understand what are the unintended consequences,
That's right.
which is kind of funny. If you put a bin out in the bush, people will probably just take more rubbish with them, or more packaging with them, knowing that they're going to be able to overflow a bin. But the moment it's overflowed, people start putting it next to the bin. And so now you've got a scenario where, people are taking all of this stuff because they know there's a bin there, but it increases the footprint versus, I know, for example, when I go camping, I will always take canned drinks because I can crush the canned drinks and I can put them in a bag and I can take them home with me, versus a bottled drink I can't take. Now, whether that's good or bad for the environment, I don't know. But I'm choosing that because there's a forcing function around how do I take my rubbish out.
Yeah, I mean, what he's saying, the issue is also that, I mean, often we don't have enough information about what is environmentally friendly or not. And I guess the way it's kind of working on a society level is that there are like certain social norms. And these social norms, they take time to, until they're kind of maybe widespread or implemented. But like, don't throw your rubbish into the bush. I think it is a social norm that's very widely accepted, and it probably not always was, but like, it's something that becomes kind of the social norm that people share and then abide to, but it takes time for these kind of norms to evolve and like to change it.
And hence why it's also very complicated, because there's social norms, there's unintended consequences. We can't understand every single policy's outcome, both in the immediate and long term. You do need probably lots of consultation or marketing campaigns to go along with policy changes so that we can normalize it, get people on board, and also explain why are we doing this? What's the point? And also to have those maybe more difficult conversations. The classic one is, why would Australia do A, B, and C when, China or pick another country is burning, coal all the time? You know what? Some of that's pretty valid. It's a pretty good argument. At the same time, if we spend a bit of time and say, two wrongs don't make a right, or what would be the alternative? Why would we want to do that? How could we support other countries? What does it mean for our economy? It becomes incredibly complicated rather than these quick shortcuts. Psychological, I think, issues arise, or disputes arise out of not being curious, not thinking positions through.
That's a good point. And like, I mean, I talked before about kind of the social identity people have, their like political ideologies, but the other one is also kind of your national identity. So how much you want Australia to succeed, or like you, there can be also this kind of us versus them dynamics in terms of, and you know, globally that you. And in climate change, it is often the discussion about looking at other countries like China and India, and like if there has been this research analyzing media, how in Australia it is discussed in terms of climate change, and there's a lot of focus on like China, like what about China, which I mean in absolute terms is valid, but like per capita Australia is much higher than China. Historically, Australia emitted much more than China. So if you think about an individual level, I mean, Australia contributes much more to climate change than China. But I guess whatever, wherever you are, you always can find justification for not acting. If you're Australia, you can say, what about China? What about the United States? If you're in China, you would say, well, but look about Australia that has per capita such high emissions. Why should we do something We didn't have this kind of economic boom that Australia had previously. Why should we do it? So wherever you are, you can kind of find your reasons of why you don't want to act. So that's always easy. Yes, it's complicated. It's always true. I mean, that's with a lot of social issues, it's always kind of a drop in the bucket kind of issue. And it is true if only one country does something, that's not going to help. But like, it also doesn't help not to do anything. So one country just needs to do something and needs to kind of like enact change, and then others hopefully will follow. And it also, there are a lot of complex dynamics there, of course. But an issue obviously is to always kind of deflect responsibility and to direct it to like other people. We see this in our everyday behaviors with other people, and this also applies how we kind of think about other countries. We like to deflect responsibility instead of like taking it ourselves.
It's quite interesting how we are so afraid of talking about our shortcomings or the facts that point in a direction we will deflect or lie or point to other examples that we're doing well at versus just saying, hey, we all agree on the value of, for example, reducing our emissions, and this is actually where we do rank. And that doesn't mean that we have to go out and immediately say, I'm going to criticize us for ranking there. It's just saying this is our baseline. This is where we're starting. And, let's aim for a shift. There's going to be potentially opportunities in the shift. There's going to be costs in the shift. There's actually opportunities and costs if we don't shift. There's just constant opportunities and costs. That's current, that's a given. You can't remove that concept. And we're just kind of saying, where do we morally want to move toward? And I think, setting reasonable examples, I it drives me mad if I talk about the moral side of this concept of, like, for example, no bullying in schools. I think even just how that is explained is poor. I think what we should be saying is something more around when we observe bullying or when we see bullying or when we're advised about bullying, we're going to actively attend to that and try and mitigate those issues rather than saying we don't have, we don't tolerate bullying. It's like bullying does happen. That's just. It's just the fact. It's almost like saying, no sunshine or no rain is like, that's going to happen. And I get that the policy, they're not trying to say it in that way, but even those messaging, those items around messaging, I think are so important, to learn as a society to be a lot more nuanced. Because, yeah, social media is not going to do it. TikTok ain't certainly going to do it. But I don't think we often do that even in our regular language. Like even in psychology, the concept of depression, I was so depressed because of X, Y, Z. No, you might have been frustrated, you might have been annoyed, or maybe you're a bit sad. But depression doesn't kind of fit in that. I was anxious. Maybe you're worried or concerned, a bit apprehensive. We're losing, I think, our ability to describe in a way that's not so generalized, or maybe not losing, because that's I think incorrect as well. I think it's probably just the nature of language, is probably what I'm saying is it would be useful, or my idealistic view would be if we were more cognizant of the language that we use. But that's an ideal as well, isn't it?
That is a good point. So, I mean, the language we use is very important in like how we actually see different phenomena. And yeah, also like I like your point about the kind of the moral aspect of it is that we like it's kind of something very human that we want to see ourselves as like being morally good. And it's both ourselves and also like the groups we identify with. So we talked about like the countries we're in. If I'm Australia, I want Australia to be a good country. And this kind of leads a lot how I perceive the world. Because if something kind of threatens my view that I'm a good person and maybe the groups I identify with, maybe it's my like sports team or it is my country, it kind of people don't like this and have very aversive reactions to that. And this again goes back to our like identities when we talk about climate change, but also other issues. So if we attack people's view that they are kind of morally good, there's kind of this kind of negative reaction. So in terms of again climate change, if I'm saying Australia's bad because uses so much coal, it's kind of feel very like an attack. And my reaction is to kind of defend my identity, Australia. And this is the same on an individual level. You can maybe criticize me to some degree, but if you criticize the view of myself as being a morally good person, I'm not gonna like it. And I, whatever you say, I'm not gonna listen to you. It doesn't matter what you're saying because you're kind of attacking my deepest part of my identity.
It's interesting how we even hold our thoughts as being part of us, and in there lies the insult. If you have a different position to myself, there's somehow an immediate tension between us, versus trying to have a stimulating, interesting conversation. But it's really hard to separate yourself from those thoughts. That we do identify them, we hold them so strongly that they become a part of our identity. And that's part of, I suppose, what's where psychology lies, is asking the question, do we need to hold that so strongly? You can still hold that moral, but how you hold it can be nuanced. It can be both morally virtuous to both reduce the use of burning coal and to increase the use of burning coal, depending on the context.
Absolutely.
And that's a classic example of, if we just cut it all off today, that would be a catastrophe, because we just don't have enough electricity generation. That would be ridiculous. But I think I like the word of transitioning or moving toward, or adopting more of, any of the renewables. And I like the word neuro, so I just mess it up. Renewables, because geothermal can be, a great source of energy, as an example, or photoelectric, no, photovol PV, I think they call it. Let's just call it solar panels. There's still a cost of production and the like, but we're still trying to do something, and there's lots of ways we could debate it and argue and the rest of it, but sometimes there are non-genuine ways that people discuss these things.
And I mean the kind of the identity could then also like change, and we see it in a country like Norway, which maybe has some similarities to Australia, which is kind of very reliant on oil. I mean Australia on coal, but they kind of changed their identity as people, even though Norway is still a very country reliant on oil. But the common view is that we think of Norway as kind of this environmentally friendly country. And it has a lot to do with them kind of adopting this kind of new identity of being actually a climate friendly nation. So Norway has the highest rate of like sales of like electrical vehicles. I think more than 90% of all new vehicles are electrical. And that's in a country that's very reliant on oil. And the question is, why is that happening? And I mean, the answer to some degree, they changed their perception of what their country is towards a more like environmentally friendly country. In the same way, if you think of Australia, if you criticize Australia of being, okay, there's a very coal-relying country, it's very a climate villain, I think there could be a way also to kind of change how Australia sees itself. And because now we would feel attacked, like Australia's kind of put down, that's negative. But we could also change the way we kind of see Australia.
What sort of changes do you think assist in encouraging us as a society in Australia to adopt more of a environmentally friendly approach? I know that at least in my small camping world, you know, that's kind of what draws like-minded people. Most people who do go to camping, they tend to already have this great love of nature. They want to be in nature. They want to sleep, you know, as close as they can to the ground, so to speak. Still lots of contradictory things, you know, if you look at all the equipment that we take out, you could point to most of it and say, wow, that's, you know, been mined and that's plastic, et cetera, but there's still at least a shared love of nature there, and that potentially influences how we are in other areas, but our footprints are still very high in terms of costs. You know, if I think about the distance I drive my vehicle to get into a piece of bush to stay there for 2 nights, you know, it's quite contradictory.
Yeah, I think this is a very complicated question, and there's definitely no easy answer to that, but I think to some degree it goes back to the kind of political issue that it's very much tied to like political identities. And if we think about something like environment, caring about the environment, that we talked about before, that it's not in all countries like that. But also, if we look within the Western world, it was not always a left-wing issue to care about the environment. Quite the opposite. So it used to be a more conservative. Actually, Edmund Burke, who is sometimes considered like the father of modern conservatism, he was an environmentalist. He wrote a lot about caring for the environment because actually part of like conservative ideology is to you want to conserve. You want to kind of conserve social systems, but you also want to conserve the environment which you inhabit. So caring about the environment in some way is a very conservative idea because it is about caring about the nature you live in. And I think part of it is we should see it also as that. It is not a left-wing issue. It is an issue that kind of also can be tied to like, yeah, conservatism. Or like other kind of political ideas. So maybe not seeing it as then a political issue at all, but yeah, we all do connect to Australian nature. We all care about kind of the country we live in. None of us wants it to be destroyed. If you're left wing, you shouldn't just assume like people that are maybe more conservative, they want to destroy Australia, they want to destroy the nature. But the other way around, too, it's about recognizing that we actually all care about this country and about our nature. Maybe our approaches differ a bit, but that's what we should focus on. But again, like kind of think about the common ground that we all have.
Such an incredibly complicated space when I also think about the rate of consumption that the world is, you know, in. I can't think of a country that the rate of consumption is not going up. It's almost like there's a human nature to consume. The more comfortable you are, the more that desire. You just start looking for the next thing. For a
Mm-hmm.
lot of Australians, we have a wardrobe full of clothes, many
Yeah.
items in which we won't ever wear. We end up throwing them out, but we continue to purchase more. Some just enjoy purchasing items and rarely wearing them and then throwing them out or passing them down. We do these small little things like, oh, I'm going to donate it, not recognizing that a lot of it ends up getting thrown out because it can't be used. Our consumption rate is high, and I can't envisage where we don't do that, and maybe there's a more environmentally friendly way to consume that doesn't require so much burning, so much damaging of the environment, but does, I can't see it slowing down.
Yeah, and that's definitely a problem, and it's hard to change, I would say, because we live in a society where there's a lot of about consumption. And even if I think about my own life, I would say when I was younger, I would much more would be much more likely to actually repair stuff that's not functioning. I would maybe more like sell it on like marketplace, like these things, and I would care much more about getting secondhand stuff. And I even witnessed myself to kind of be much more likely to buy new stuff just because it's cheap, it's convenient, and we kind of live in a society where it's just so convenient to just buy a new item and just get rid of the old one. Not sure how to deal with this issue. But I feel like a lot of people are actually not happy with that. I hear a lot of people saying, oh, back in the day, we did care about what we owned. It like lasted for a long time. So it feels like we are kind of in this dynamic where we buy new stuff. But a lot of us, we actually do like the idea of holding on to stuff to not overconsume. So it almost feels like we are in this pattern without actually wanting this. Or some people maybe do, but a lot of people don't. Feeling, but I have no science to back any this one up. It's just my observation of how I feel. People feel about consumption.
It's complicated. We consume differently depending on so many factors, where the when we time is obviously a I believe a huge factor in most of these things. I think if you lived in a country where resources were very low, and then we just try and pick one small thing like where do you get rid of your rubbish, the time factor and the cost factor makes it very attractive to throw, for example, food to throw rubbish into a fire. Or throw rubbish into a river, or just potentially just throw it out the window. The time and cost becomes a fairly strong influencing factor. Similarly, we try and do things like recycling in Australia, and we give bins out. But how many bins do you provide, and what's the cost of that, and how much can we actually extract and use? It's a great idea. How we execute it is unbelievably complicated. There are still these forcing functions of it requires economic viability. It's kind of like the electric cars. My understanding from the limited reading and my limited, well, I'm very interested in it, but I haven't necessarily looked into it so much. The possibility of electric cars has been around for more than 100 years. It lost the race against a gasoline engine, so to speak. It doesn't mean that it hasn't been useful, but it lost the commercial fight. And the commercial fight was very complicated and difficult, and people had tried it even previously until Tesla somehow broke through. But that was against all odds, and there was huge market forces, and there's been lots of foul play. because it's going to be unbelievably expensive, and already is currently, for mainstream, legacy automakers to retool and the rest of it. So it was never a question of what was better. It was a question of what was cheaper or what was marketed better. What was so it's kind of funny that on a moral sense, I think many of us kind of get what direction we want to be leaning into, but the forcing function becomes really hard,
Absolutely.
so that's an interesting observation.
Because it's not only what we believe is right, it's also how easy it is, and also can we do it? Like if something is really difficult, it is we're just less likely to do it. So for example, I moved from Melbourne to Brisbane, and just in Brisbane, it's when it comes to public transportation, it's just a bit harder. So it's much harder to get from one place to the other compared to Melbourne. So what I did at some point, I tried to take public transportation, but then I kind of gave in. I bought a car, and I bought a petrol car just because it was secondhand. I didn't have the money to buy a new electric vehicle. And despite me caring about the environment, I care a lot about climate change, but I just felt like this is impossible, and I gave in. Because as an individual, it is very hard for me to kind of change if there's no system in place that kind of makes it easy for me. But if you live in a place where it's easy to take public transportation, electric vehicles are cheap, then people are also going to do it. But if the barriers are very high, we are all just humans. So it's not good to just point fingers, oh, this person doesn't do this or that. It's like it can be very hard for people. And we, despite our moral values, despite about caring about things, we still want certain convenience. We don't want our life to be extremely difficult, where we always have to get out of the way, take 1 hour bus to A from A to B. That's just
And I think that it's a beautiful example because it says that both things can coexist. If there was electric cars that were available that were secondhand of a comparable quality and cost, then that would have been a very easy decision. But because currently there's very few electric vehicles on the market, and there's a lot of teething issues with how people use them and all the challenges around it and the infrastructure and the like becomes complicated. And so, we can believe in it and continue to believe in it, but it doesn't mean that every decision that we do will be aligned with it because there's a cost. I can use the same example, but just talk about even just composting. I'm more than happy to put my rubbish in my bin with a red lid, and put all my green waste from cutting the lawn and doing the landscaping into the bin with the green lid. There is no bin for composting, and so all of the food that we consume or don't consume and we throw out, it's just harder for me to go out and dig up the backyard and put it in or buy a unit and flip it around and so on and so forth. Is it possible? Can I do it? You bet I can. Of course I can. Would I love to have compost to use in the garden? Of course I would. Do I want to put in that effort? No. And so I'll buy a bag of compost and I'll use it, but I'll throw my other scraps in the bin. We could complain and easily point at government and say they should be providing us with a compost bin and so on and so, that's a, I think, a lazy way to think about this, and we can all contribute, but also look at, what are the driving forces, and I think I had a different a previous guest talk about the trying to figure out what are the high impact areas that I could potentially target if I was that way inclined. It's a great idea, and I agree with it. It makes a lot of sense. Just humans don't tend to do that en masse.
Exactly. I mean, the highest impact one would be not having children, and not many people would be willing to not have children because of environmental issue. That's just not what we do, because it's such an important thing to us to have children. And the risk kind of is, by like pushing these arguments too much, the people just think it's ridiculous. We have to do like all these kind of high impact things, and like everything is so difficult. So it makes people more likely to just kind of, okay, like they take it too far. It's like, I just need to change my whole life. That's just not gonna be effective. I mean, some other high impact are maybe more feasible, and there could be also more these kind of systemic factors that help. So eating less beef, for example, it could be like that other diets get cheaper, and it could motivate people to eat less of like certain kind of foods like beef that are not so good for the environment. So some high impact behaviors may be more feasible. But yeah, something like not having children, and also people, yeah, not going on a holiday is another one. The people are just, it's good if you do it, but the reality is that a lot of people are not willing to sacrifice so much for like something, for like this kind of bigger abstract thing, which is climate change, which is so vague and abstract, and I need to sacrifice so much personally. It's wonderful if people do it, but we need to deal with the reality that people are just not willing to do that. That's why we need to have a more kind of maybe country level systemic approach to make it easier for people to either engage in certain behaviors, or they can engage in behaviors that are now bad. So, for example, owning a big house, it's not great, because if you heat, if you have aircon on, you have like a lot of rooms to kind of cool or heat. But this could be just solved by not generating energy via coal, but having renewable energy. Then we can have aircon on all we want. We can use, or like not all we want, but like we can use much more. It's not going to be an issue anymore.
Yes.
So it's much easier to actually having this kind of broader system level change. And then in this case, our behavior doesn't have to change.
How do you see the world moving forward? I have an optimism bias, and I very much love the world of technological advancement, and I think science fiction is moving closer towards science fact, with things like robotics and AI and the potential of almost an unlimited resource of labor. Maybe not in my lifetime, where it will be common in every single home, but I don't think we're too many generations away where, if I do want to do composting, I might just Siri that out. I might just say, "Siri, take my compost out," or it might actually already be automated into the system. So after I eat, a robot comes and delicately removes the bits into their respective, categories, and puts them in garbage bins and so on, with no cost, other than the initial outlay. So I'm very much an optimist. I genuinely believe that our rubbish tips will be absolute gold mines. When we have robotics and there's no OH&S problems with robots going in and ripping out all of the resources that we've dug up in the past. I'm sure there'll be technological advancements in how we can do recycling in a much more efficient and economic way. I see this, and I genuinely believe it. I could be completely wrong, At the same time, I'm not wedded to what happens ultimately. I'm a little bit fatalistic. I think they might be part of evolution. I don't see it happening in many thousands of years, so I don't. I'm not an alarmist on that level. These are all assumptions, but it allows me to sleep, and allows me to live happily. I don't know. These are just, yeah, completely subjective. How do you see the world? Obviously, this is something that you research. You do look at the, morality side of psychology, and the environmental space, climate change. It's all very complicated. What's your general view of the future?
So I wouldn't call myself an optimist, but I don't think I'm necessarily a pessimist. So I also wouldn't call myself alarmist. I think humans dealt with huge issues in the past. So I genuinely believe that humans, we can deal with big issues like climate change. But there are also a lot of other issues we're facing right now, like wars, nuclear weapons, whatever these issues is. I do believe we have the capacity, but I'm also not optimistic because like it does go in a bad direction when we think about climate change. The consequences probably will be devastating. And also in other social issues, wealth inequality, there are a lot of directions we go into that are not good, and I think it will be hard for us to actually change. I'm also not a techno-optimist, I would say. So I do, okay, let's say it like this. I don't believe in like these big technologies that kind of can solve issues like climate change. I do think that technological advancement will play a huge role. Just so we live now in a capitalistic system. So whatever we do is kind of decided by that. And I think one big step towards what brings us closer to be carbon neutral is better solar panels. Because if they're better, they will be cheaper than coal or oil. And that will make countries to actually change. Electric cars, if they become very cheap to produce and they also are maybe less costly and because it uses less energy than actually using petrol, this will make people to actually buy it. So I do believe that these technological advancement will make a difference. And there could be also a quick change. It's hard to predict. So suddenly solar panels could be super cheap, and then everybody, wants to implement them just because it's the cheap option. It's hard to predict. I don't believe in these big inventions that kind of just solve our issues. I think they might be a bit simplified. But I'm also not overly pessimistic that I'm saying climate change is happening, nothing we can do, the world is gonna end. And I think we easily kind of, if we're concerned about something, and it's very understandable, we go towards an extreme that we kind of feel like there's nothing we can do. It's like, you just feel like this very doomist kind of view of the world, which is very understandable because we feel fear. And so we are more inclined to actually envision a very terrible future. But what it does, it just paralyzes us. And I think there are solutions. And also one thing maybe I also want to say about climate change, that a lot of discussion is also about winning or losing against climate change. There's like this kind of rhetoric, we lost the fight against climate change, or like we need to win the fight against climate change. But there's no winning or losing. So climate change is going to happen and it's already happening. So it's just the question is, how bad is it going to get? There's no winning or losing. Every fossil fuel that we don't burn, it's like it's better for the climate. And we shouldn't have this kind of war-like rhetoric where we like winning the war against climate change or losing it. I think it's all not very helpful, and it takes us into like a very pessimistic kind of we adopt a very pessimistic perspective. It's not helpful for dealing with climate change. It's also definitely not helpful for us. That we feel bad, it kind of paralyzes us. We feel a lot of fear and anxiety around this issue, which is very understandable, but it's not good for our mental health. It's not good for our society. It's not good in general.
I think beautifully said. I think so many of these things, like the technological advancements, they certainly won't solve it. I can definitely imagine that as robotics come into the world, we will want them more and more, which is my
Absolutely,
assumption.
yeah,
And we don't know what that actually then means as to what else we will do. But I can certainly assure you, if there were robots that were available today that were commercially viable, and let's say they cost $20,000 each, and they could do
absolutely.
numerous things around the home. Who wouldn't buy two? I'd forego a car,
Yeah.
or you'd work harder and save up to buy two of those, because the opportunities would be immense. And so how that would then change our behaviors and what we do, potentially retirement would start looking much more interesting, because you would say, well, if so many of my items are achieved, maybe retirement could be an option. I can actually get my robot to do my gardening that will then produce me my food, that will then
Your
produce me these
podcast.
beautiful meals, all organically grown, because I've got this $20,000 machine. It's going to change a lot of things. I do like your idea about this isn't a win-lose. And maybe that's also nice, that we don't have a win-lose, a right or wrong, that we take away judgment. Sometimes evolution does go out and entice us to go out and say this is right, this is wrong. But we do know that even if there were no humans on the planet, you would still have animals going extinct, because you have one species that becomes dominant that might eat its way into extinction itself, but it will also extinguish numerous others at the same time. Kind of potentially what might be occurring for us. Extinction isn't a novel concept. And so, yeah, as a matter of fact, we kind of know that, because we've got lots of fossils and all sorts of things, and it's not just because of one cataclysmic event. I'm assuming, I don't know, but I imagine extinction is not something that's only occurring because of humans. Yes, we're doing it at a much higher rate. It would have to be possible, but if you allowed for rabbits to just ravish an area, they might actually go out and inadvertently kill other species if they got out of hand. Maybe I'm not looking at this right, but I like the idea of not being right, wrong, good, bad, because evolution keeps asking new questions about what's the new way that we adapt, that we adopt something, the way that it pushes forcing functions. Animals are constantly moving, and we've seen how they've adopted over time as well, with human intervention. But I believe that historically, the Earth has changed many a time, depending on many factors as well. So I really like that. No right, wrong, no win, lose. If we have a moral appreciation that I think most of us hold, and say, do we want to burn fossil fuels? Do we want to pollute the world? Do we want to throw rubbish? Do we want to use resources with no thought whatsoever, and damage the environment? Most of us still hold a right, wrong there, and there's a general consensus. I think that's a very reasonable thing. We want a better world for the next generation, for our children. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, probably the best thing you could do is not have a child. Well, kind of silly, all right? And we can hold both things and not necessarily go right, wrong, have a nice conversation, do what we can, but also not get too down about it, because it can feel quite bleak.
I think that the way we frame also the solution, and I think that's something you in some way mentioned through this is whether we frame it in a more like positive or negative way, so we can talk about species extinction as framing in a very negative or like kind of loss way. We're losing species, we're losing, and we have all these kind of negative consequences of climate change. But we can also have a more like a win frame. We all, or many of us, appreciate the beauty of nature. We want to go into the bush, have a bushwalk, see the birds. We want to see the wildlife, the beautiful nature. So we kind of, through protecting our nature, we're winning a lot because we kind of have this beautiful nature that we can all enjoy. So it's all, it's also about, yeah, how do we frame it? It's not all negative. Climate change, if we don't have petrol cars, like our streets will be less polluted, like what we're breathing is like a cleaner air. There's a lot to win. So it's not just about this kind of negative thing. We need to stop things in order to prevent the terrible thing that's happening. But also there's a lot to win because a lot of things we appreciate, clean air, beautiful nature. I think that's also what most of us have in common. We do appreciate it. No matter what your political orientation is, no matter what your income is, we all kind of live in this country, in this society, and we appreciate certain things. And yeah, it's very much about the framing and like the focus we're having around these issues.
And maybe there's even a position to potentially play with around maybe, you know, today's history that we're making and the recent history that we've looked at is very much an expansion period. And there might be other expansion periods or there might be contraction periods in all sorts of spaces, whether it's the expansion of how much land we use for food production, technological advancement might reduce that, you know, or might expand that further again. We don't know. But if we can reserve judgment, still live in the most moral way that we can and think about it, because it's not about having complacency. Optimism isn't about complacency. I think it's still trying to be active in promoting positive change. So there's still some judgment going on, but at the same time, pessimism is a great motivating factor as well, because it can also help to not be complacent, saying there's an urgency around this, and the sooner we transition, the better it is in general. And that's, I mean, you know, everyone knows that early intervention across the board, pretty much in everything, tends to be more favourable. So, makes a lot of sense. Christoph, where can people find out more, or what resources could listeners go and look out for, read, watch any books, any courses? How can they get in, you know, more involved in this space around whether it's moral psychology or, you know, looking at the social environmental you know, intersections of this? How would we find out more?
That's a good question. Well, I would say this depends also a lot on where you personally stand in terms of climate change. So because we want to read, we like to read a lot that kind of confirms already our views that we already have in the first place. And I would say if you may be more skeptical about climate policies, maybe, I'm not sure any specific, there are a lot of books, good books out there, maybe a bit more provocative is Naomi Klein, This Changes Everything. It's one book about climate change. There's a lot of interesting scientific articles for the more nerdier people. One that I really like is, it's by a person called Maniatis, and it's called Individualization of Responsibility. And it talks kind of about the issues that we very much individualize the responsibility of issues, and in this case, particularly climate change, but you can also apply it to other issues where we see it as just individual responsibility and we don't kind of take this kind of more collective responsibility. If you're more on the side that you already do care a lot about climate change, you may be an environmental activist, I would just recommend to also maybe seek out the perspectives of people like coal miners or people that are affected. Something that I personally found very interesting, there's like this maybe 30-minute Vice documentary, which is called What Coal Miners Think About Climate Change. And it is about coal miners in Queensland and like their perspective. And it kind of gave me a very good idea. It's like, yes, it's not that they don't just care, we don't care about climate change. It's very much people feel threatened about their jobs. They feel threatened about their communities. So if you're more on the environmental activist or concerned side, I would recommend maybe start there and just to get also the perspective of people that might be affected by these climate policies and maybe think about a way to yeah, not dismiss their perspective, to maybe include it into your view of like climate change and where we should go.
Beautifully said. I think being curious and asking questions allows us to understand the other, and if it's not in a confrontational way, there's more opportunity for us to see the other position, to integrate. You know, if we fall into an argument, we tend to just, you know, as you said, we kind of move further and further towards confirmation bias rather than curiosity. I really, really like that, and it's a great resources there as well. I'm currently reading a book called Bad Therapy, by Abigail Schreier, I think her name is. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I think, you know, psychology is wonderful. I think it's got a lot of merit and value. You know, this book is hypothesizing, or not even hypothesizing, it's pointing out that there are iatrogenic factors that should be considered in therapy. And it's quite I think insightful, and it poses questions about, you know, particularly language and what expectations are with clients, and you know, what does therapy target and do, and how can it be used? You know, it's maybe a bit scary, you know, if we look at the title Bad Therapy, and it's probably written in a way that tries to push an argument, which it kind of needs to be an interesting book. We don't tend to kind of go, oh, it's got all these caveats, and so therefore, what does it say? But if we can read it with curiosity and go, yeah, you know, that's not a strange concept. The fact that there's even a word around that tells us that there's a word for this, and there's these unintended consequences. That doesn't mean the whole of therapy is terrible or should be thrown in the bin. But we should consider it, and I like that idea of you know, hearing the, you know, coal miner's perspective, so to speak. I will be definitely following that up, because that sounds, you know, extremely interesting, and then also looking at the other side of, you know, our individual responsibilities, because it's so easy to go out and say, oh, you know, look what China's doing, or you know, look what Australia's doing per capita. It's like, these are shortcuts, and a little bit sort of cognitively lazy, or you know, if we call them our heuristics. So you know, very well, great point there, and I think curiosity allows us to have conversations with everyone, and therefore not be reinforced into our current position, you know, because either idealistic view held tightly is probably going to have some unintended consequences. So, you know, well said, Christoph.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you on the program. Fantastic conversation. Thank you so much. You've got so many insights. I wish we had more time. I know that the listeners would have enjoyed that as well. And I think it's a nice way to approach, you know, climate change and looking at it from, you know, all angles, and trying to push those limits and see what we can do, because it shouldn't be a win or lose, a for or against. You know, we can, I think, have a look at what our commonalities are, which I think is, as we both said, much greater and have at least some optimism around that, and then look at what are the policies or what can we go out and advocate for. I think we should all advocate for change, based on our values, morals, ethics, and that's positive all around. So thanks, Christoph. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed a lot talking to you. Thanks so much.